Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. Today, we are very pleased to welcome Philip Hamburger. He is a legal scholar and professor of law at Columbia, but most importantly, he is the CEO of New Civil Liberties Alliance. Philip, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
We wanted to speak with you because of your expertise on civil liberties. Today, we are focused on the Chevron Doctrine and its overturning in the Supreme Court. Please tell us why you think this is a very important decision and what we should be taking away from it.
Right. Thanks. And I should explain that I've been seeking this for about a decade. In 2014, I published a book called Is Administrative Law Unlawful? And you can guess the answer. Yes. and then about five or six years ago, I started something called the New Civil Liberties Alliance, which was designed to defend our civil liberties from the administrative state, because it's really not just a structural problem, separation of powers problem, it's an assault on our constitutional rights, and particularly on our procedural rights, and that's relevant to Chevron. Right, so this summer, in a case called Loper-Bright and in a parallel case that was our case, the Relentless case, the Chevron doctrine was expressly overturned. And they've been heading that way. The Supreme Court stopped. We've been pushing them on this. And around 10 years ago, they began to slow down. They did not rely on Chevron. So it was already a dead man walking, but many agencies still rely on it. And the less sophisticated lower courts still relied on it. So it matters to get rid of it finally and clearly. And although it was done just on statutory grounds, Justice Roberts very clearly makes evident that those statutory grounds are based on constitutional grounds. So this is a hard end to Chevron. But why does that matter? Well, I think there are two reasons, and just to frame it out very broadly, legislative and judicial reasons. A lot of what Chevron did is it said that where there's an ambiguity or silence in a statute, an agency that's authorized by that statute can fill in the gaps by making regulations. So it ended up giving agencies sort of legislative power to regulate, even where Congress didn't intend that, where it just was silent or ambiguous. So a lot of regulation depends on Chevron as a sort of authorization. And now that's gone. That's nice. And it's not that I'm against all regulation. It's just there should be congressional authorization for congressional enactment of regulation. And that was missing. So that level of accountability to popular opinion and to the people through legislation is being somewhat restored by getting rid of Chevron. Now, there's another half that I should just mention that most people don't pay attention to, but really, really matters. And that's the judicial side. If the government goes after you in an enforcement action for not complying with a regulation, they'll usually do it in an administrative proceeding. And then you can petition to have that reheard by a court. But in all those decisions, even in the courts, what Chevron requires, it says to the judges, you have to, in certain circumstances, follow the agency interpretation of the statute. And those interpretations, of course, could be actually not just interpretation, it's lawmaking. It's really quite wild stuff. And what that meant was not only does the agency have legislative power, but the judge gives up judicial power. The judge has to stop exercising independent judgment. They have to defer to the agency's judgment as to what the law is. And that meant you weren't really getting justice in the courts. The courts were actually biased. I called it Chevron bias, because if you're an agency, you're coming after me. There's just sort of a big thumb on the scale for your interpretation of the law. And that isn't justice. That's not what judges are meant to do. So both legislatively and judicially, this is a profound and important change. It's very gratifying.
The Bitcoin Layer is proud to be sponsored by Unchained, the leader in Bitcoin financial services. Unchained empowers you to take full control of your Bitcoin with collaborative multi-sig vaults where you hold two of three keys and benefit from a Bitcoin security partner. This is a really important feature. You can purchase Bitcoin directly into your cold storage with Unchained's trading desk and completely eliminate your exchange risks. Unchained also offers the best IRA product in the industry. You can convert easily your 401k or IRA into Bitcoin while keeping control of your keys. Don't pay more in taxes than you have to. Go talk to them today, unchained.com/TBL, and make sure you use code TBL for $99 off when you create an account. Imagine losing your Bitcoin fortune to a house fire or to accidental damage. A complete nightmare, right? It's estimated that over 30% of Bitcoin are lost forever, and poor seed phrase security is a big reason why. That is why we use Stampseed, a really cool DIY kit that allows you to stamp your seed into these titanium plates. So let me show you how it works. They send you a titanium plate. Part of the kit comes with this really easy to use tracker. You slide your seed phrase into the tracker. Now you take the letters that they send you, you take a letter out, and you place it into your device, and then you take this incredibly heavy duty titanium hammer, and you hammer your letters into this titanium plate. Your full seed phrase will be stamped into this titanium plate that is fireproof, accident-proof, damage-proof. These tools have been specifically designed by people working in titanium stamping for over 14 years. So go check them out today, stampseed.com, and make sure you use code TBL for 15% off of your order. Profound change indeed, and we want to understand the fallout. Of course, you're going to be involved in many cases on in terms of what is going to be next for the regulatory state. But I want to first ask you, we are far from legal experts here, so we want to understand from a civics perspective, from a constitutional perspective, how does this case overturning impact the separation of powers, the three branches of government? Right. How does this play into the three branches of government? And maybe you can even mention this popular idea that there's a fourth branch of government, or that there are all these shadow branches of government that we aren't aware of. So how does that all play together, please?
Right. The Constitution gives us three parts of government. There isn't just a government. There are three branches, and they act independently, sometimes cooperatively, but they each have their own mode of action. Congress is being elected, makes laws, and we're bound by those laws because we consent through elections. The judges are the very opposite. They're not meant to be political at all. They exercise independent judgment in resolving cases. And the executive exercises sort of the force or action of the nation, not lawmaking power, not judicial power. And that's a very pretty thing, and it actually does serve, I know it's an old theory, but it really matters, because it means that whoever goes after you by making law or by prosecuting you or by judging you can't exercise other powers. So that limits what they do and makes them specialize. And in a sense, it comes out of a theory of specialization of action. You know, if you teach a child to cross the street, you teach them to pause, right, and look, to exercise judgment. And then to make a decision to cross, and then actually, that's judgment, and then to act. So all modern decision-making theory is based on the separation of specialization of powers. I don't know if your listeners are interested. Have you ever heard of the OODA loop? One of the reasons we were able to prevail in the Korean War was because of this theory of combat fighting. A fighter pilot had to observe and orient, decide, and then act. It was about breaking up decision-making into its component parts. And that's true in our Constitution. Unfortunately, the administrative state unravels that. It's not really a fourth branch of government. What it does is the administrative state is really taking the legislative power of Congress and the judicial power of the courts and giving it to the executive, so that the one branch, the executive power, has all of this authority. Now, that's dangerous for 1,000 reasons. An agency can come to you, and this is true probably in the crypto field, but, an agency can come to you and they'll say, we don't have a regulation against you yet, but we can make one next week. even though that's the executive branch, it's not Congress. And you have to worry that under other regulations, they might adjudicate in a biased way because they don't like you because you've been resistant. I tend to ask when I meet bankers, I ask them, or bank lawyers, I say, would you ever challenge your regulator? And suddenly a conversation goes silent and they start whispering. They sort of shrink down and they say, we would never challenge our regulator. And that's because there's a thousand ways for the regulators to go after them, and you cannot afford that. This is an extraordinarily unjust mode of governance. It tends to all sorts of violations of liberties. An economist would say it's also slightly inefficient. So it matters to keep these things apart. And what Chevron did is it added to the confusion, because what Chevron did is it said, you can not only do the agencies get to make law when Congress gives it away to them and authorizes it, but even when Congress didn't, they can go ahead and make regulations. And it also said, oh, the judges, they don't just, when in an administrative case, they might not be judging at all. They just have to be prejudiced against the ordinary Americans. Completely terrible decision, just corrupt in every way. So it's a delight to get rid of it.
And so we're getting rid of the administrative state, but it's just the beginning. So now how is it going to unfold? What's the process? Right. How do these agencies get stripped of power? What's the what is the process by which? And let me also ask you, what are the agencies that are in the crosshairs here that might be really stripped away first?
Right. All agencies have something at stake in this, and they're all pushing back. Now, how are you going to do that? If you think you have a number of things you can do, I think you can go high or low. You know high-low poker? Well, it's like that. One thing you can do is aim high. You can only make regulations where you have congressional authorization. It's not too much to ask. But what if you can't do that? Well, then you aim low. You can no longer make a regulation and say it's authorized because Congress was ambiguous or silent, and therefore Chevron gives it to us. So what you do instead, I think they'll be doing, is moving to so-called guidance. Guidance is a label for when an agency says, we're not regulating, and it's not binding, but we're just telling you how we interpret the law and our regulations. But of course, if you're a regulated party, you know what that means. It means they want you to toe that new line. And if you don't, they'll find some way of getting you. And their own judges in their internal non-court courts, these unconstitutional little ALJs, well, they'll follow guidance. If you're forced into a real court, and we can talk about that later, the courts won't make guidance binding. So what they're going to do is they're going to expand guidance. Now, why is that good for them? One of the advantages of guidance is, according to the Supreme Court, most guidance is not final agency action. Translation into English, you can't challenge it in court. So this is a beauty for them. They can really sink, as I call this, sub-administrative governance. They can fall below administrative power into this sort of neverland that you avoid judicial review. So I'm worried about that. And of course, we're already busy trying to clamp down on the various evasions that we'll see.
And what are some of those examples that now you're seeing on the front lines?
I don't have an example of that yet. We're still looking for cases on that in particular. But I'll give you an example of where Chevron deference is being disputed. So I don't know if you know about tax law.
Explain it to us, please.
Right. So in tax law, there's a statute, the Internal Revenue Code. And then there's a much larger body of so-called law, it isn't, but they pretend, which are the regulations issued by the IRS, interpreting that law and giving it effect. And whether those are authorized by the Internal Revenue Code, that is, under current doctrine, permissible. I think it's illegitimate, but so be it. But then there's a question as to the regulations that are filling gaps in the statute where there was just ambiguity or silence, where the regulations are not actually authorized by Congress. Do those regulations still have any force post-Chevron? The IRS undoubtedly thinks that those are you know, perfectly good regulations, that Chevron should just have prospective effect. But really, that's hard to see, given that there's a constitutional underpinning to the anti-Chevron cases, Loper Bright and Relentless. Now, they may come back and say, well, the decisions this summer were based on statute under the Administrative Procedure Act. And formally, that's true. But underlying that, again, is constitutional law. So I suspect we're going to end up having to litigate that and similar such cases from other agencies. And that'll be fun.
Now, you mentioned the regulation toward the digital asset sphere. We have seen over the last 4 years the current administration basically unfold this Operation Choke Point, in which they're going after companies that are engaged in this industry broadly. And so it is really a part of what we're looking at and thinking about how that's going to evolve. The decision helps the premise that the arbitrary regulation is not really healthy for, you know, free enterprise. Right. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts there.
Right. I would just throw in here, we represent people for free. Fortunately, people give money to us to defend civil liberties. And so we represent people for free. And we do this in the sphere precisely to protect people who are affected by this sort of thing. So yes, that's a sort of case that might very much interest us. Operation Choke Point, what is it about? The choke point is it can be any service or industry that we're very dependent upon. That's the choke point. That could be banking, so people can be debanked. They can be denied licenses, if you need a license to be in a particular business. This was used against payday lenders, right? One of the ways this is done is everyone needs a banker or an insurance company. And so if you don't have statutory authority to regulate people, and there wasn't for payday lenders and for people being debanked for political reasons and so forth. And I know in your business, this is sort of an absence of a lot of regulation. So how are they going to regulate it? What they do is they say, well, banks need to avoid reputational risk. Right. So you go to the banks and you say, have you thought about this client? Are you worried about reputational risk? And it's usually done in a question, not a direct command. And the banks think, oh, right. We'll look into that. And if you don't act, they'll say, are you sure there's no reputational risk? And that translates as, we're going to hassle you until you cooperate. And then the banks withdraw banking services. And bingo, companies go out of business, or they're just left stranded with money they can't use. There's a number of ways this plays out. This is grotesque behavior. This falls into that category of sub-administrative behavior. It's a form of extortion. And although some extortion seems to be slightly justified allegedly by statute, this has no justification and is grossly unconstitutional. Making law and adjudicating and executing all those powers in one, with no foundation in the Constitution, no foundation in statute. It's really execrable behavior, and it's profoundly dangerous because it can be used for political reasons too, right? In the crypto field, it's used because they want to regulate and don't have authority against many people. And a good example with the truckers in Canada, it's used for overtly political reasons. And this is just dangerous.
Absolutely. So an extortion tactic, and one that is wildly unjust. Philip, I want to ask you about the IRS and the illegitimacy of some of that code. So when you said the word illegitimate, were you referring to parts of the tax code or parts of the law, the IRS in general? I want to hear, because it's a highly charged agency.
Right. I think I'm quite moderate. I'm not arguing against taxation. We need sovereign states in order to protect our civil liberties. But that also means they can't have so much power in the areas where they might threaten those civil liberties. How do we do that? We have the divided government you're talking about. Congress should be making laws. Congress should regulate us. Congress, according to the Constitution, has the power, for example, to regulate commerce. That doesn't mean others should have that power. So yes, we have to have tax laws. I regret having to pay so many taxes, but I understand why we have taxes. But it should be by law, not by regulation. Regulation, meaning what's done by agencies, is really a perversion of our constitutional system. It's very important, particularly for controversial areas of law, be it taxes or criminal law, for Congress to be making the law, because then it has all the authority that comes with the consent of the governed. And it's, you know, the administrative types think you can evade that by having an agency make the law. But they're actually undermining the very legitimacy of the governance they seek, because a law that's passed by Congress, well, you had a political fight, you lost it. This is our system of government, got to live with it. When an agency does it, you know there's a lot of problems of capture and just executive control that's dangerous. So the danger is, I don't want to argue against taxes. What I'm arguing against is a method of enacting taxes that takes it out of the hands of Congress. We fought against Britain to have taxes enacted by our representatives. I don't think it's too much to ask that we still do that. And then the other side of the coin is on the judicial side. And there it gets very complicated, but there's some reason to question whether the IRS should be, in a sense, adjudicating most of its own disputes. And the question of the tax court, I don't want to dig into it now. It's also a difficult constitutional question. And it seems to me that when there's any doubt, government should err on the side of doing what's right on the constitutionally. And that means enacting laws. Congress, and there's no doubt that that's what should be done. And on the judicial side, where it's complicated, I think it should be in the courts.
What is the current front lines fight in terms of leaving the legitimacy of the government's right to tax, but taking away a lot of that authority from the IRS to make individual decisions?
I used to be a tax lawyer, so I'll just begin by saying this is a deeper rabbit hole than you really want to go into. But to keep things very straightforward and simple, it's pretty fundamental and very clear under the Constitution that laws that bind us should be made by Congress. Agencies cannot make law, and when they make rule, you know, we had rule of law, now we have rule by rules, right? And in the sort of, in the choke point situations, it's really rule by harassment, right? And these are degradations from the rule of law, a descent into a sort of governance that's really quite dangerous and not consistent with our constitutional traditions. On the adjudicatory side, on the judicial side, so one thing that the IRS can do is to make determinations of what you owe, right? They're not adjudicating. They're simply saying, this is the law. We've determined that you owe a certain amount. And they do this. It's not very pleasant, but it's not necessarily, just because it's unpleasant doesn't mean it's unlawful. That can be perfectly constitutional if it's framed, again, by statutes and that are clear enough and that they're not actually making policy or judicial power in doing that. A lot of the problem arises in these determinations from the ambiguities involved that the IRS usually resolves in its own favor and things like that. But the structure, you know, of what the IRS can do is all there on the Constitution. They can tax under statutes, and they can make determinations of your legal duties. We need to have a vigorous taxation system. But it should be done with accountability, both by statute and the judiciary. And that has dissipated. And that's worrisome. It doesn't end well when people don't trust our system of governance, including the system of taxation. It's just not what we need.
Philip, the last question I'll ask you is, what is your source of optimism here? We want to take away a message of that maybe, yes, we are moving in the right direction. You mentioned that this overturning this doctrine is something that you yourself have personally been working on for many years. So give us a little bit of a sense of optimism here looking forward.
Actually, it's not that many years. If you think about it, so for over 100 years, the administrative state has grown and grown. We've seen the rise and rise of the administrative state, as Professor Gary Lawson would put it. It never seems to stop growing. But in the last 5 years, 6 years, actually since the New Civil Liberties Alliance has been litigating, we've seen a retreat. And the last summer or so has been transformative. First, And, you know, the NCLA and its allies, let me tell you what we've done just in the last year and a half. First, we've restored your right to be tried in an Article III court. That's a series of decisions make this clear. The Axon-Cochran case, Michelle Cochran was our client, the Corner Post case, and most recently the Jarkissi case. You have a right to be heard and tried in an Article III court when they're regulating you. Second, we've revived the right to a jury. That's the Jarkissi case brought by one of our allies. You now have a right. The SEC, that was an SEC case. The SEC goes after you. They have to afford you a jury in a real court. That's amazing. That's, again, transformative. And then third, we've defeated Chevron deference by reviving your right to have a judge exercise his own independent judgment and not defer, be biased in favor of the government. So the judicial side of the Ministry of State is now profoundly under question. And we've seen a real restoration of power to the courts and to judges within those courts and to juries. That's wonderful. And that was basically a large part of our strategy. And going forward, we want to press that home and then also work on preventing Congress from delegating or divesting itself of its legislative power. So what is amazing is we really can make a change. And it's very, you know, people call me every week, you know, with their cases, and usually we can't take them because we only take cases that strategically change the nature of the law. We're a small operation with minor amount of funding. We have to be very careful about the cases we take. But that's very, it's gratifying talking to all these people because everyone has a sense that we now are seeing a fundamental change in our system of government back, not restore the Constitution, but reviving it. In fact, you know, think about the right to a jury. You might think that's an old-fashioned way of resolving cases. It's never been more important, right? Once you've been deprived of a jury, you realize that is crucial. You really need that. If I may make a final plea to your listeners, if you want to defend your civil liberties from the administrative state, consider giving to the New Civil Liberties Alliance. We're the only organization that's devoted to fighting the administrative state. We view it as a civil liberties fight. We're completely non-political. In 6 years, I think we've already made a profound difference, and we hope to do more than that in the coming 5 or 6 years.
Philip Hamburger, legal scholar, professor at Columbia, First Amendment scholar, and tireless advocate for civil liberties, and of course, the CEO of New Civil Liberties Alliance. Thank you so much for joining us today at the Bitcoin Layer. Please tell people one last time where they can find you.
They can find me if you just search on the web for the New Civil Liberties Alliance or NCLA. It's not a basketball team. It's a civil rights organization, the NCLA, and you can find details there. Thank you.
Philip Hamburger, thanks for joining us. We'll catch you guys next time.
I look forward to it. Have a good day.